It is a joy to be returning to the pulpit, returning to the Psalms with you this day. I've been so blessed by the messages that we have heard, the encouragement of it. The music today was just such an encouragement to my heart. It was just a little bittersweet because today's the last day that Josh Hale will be playing drums with his team and is finishing an internship in our student ministries department because he's heading off, can you believe it? He's heading off to work at another church. He's been called to be the youth pastor at a church over in Pennsylvania, and we rejoice for him. We just continue to see how God uses us, gives us great people for a while and sends them out, and we're so grateful for Josh and his service to us over the past year. We're back in the Psalms, and I just want to say a couple things by way of review, because I know we have some guests here. Last year and this, we've been spending our summer in the Psalms. It's a break from our normal series. We have 10 or 11 weeks where we do the Psalms, and with 150 Psalms, we are set with a preaching plan for the summers for at least a decade, and we should be okay with that. Last year, we dug in. This year, we're there again, and we're looking at a lot of different kinds of Psalms, because there are different kinds of Psalms. We've been considering together the Psalms because it is God's songbook and prayer book for his people. It's a book that was 1,000 years in the making because Moses wrote the earliest psalm that we know, and somebody during the captivity of Israel wrote some of the last psalms that we know. So over that whole period, these psalms are not given to us in the order they were written. They are given to us in an order that's designed to take us through a process of learning about God. The two great themes of this book are learning how to have faith in the law, the word of God, and how God's people need to trust in his rule through his king. Now, David was a king, but he was pointing to a greater king. And during the course of the captivity, they didn't have a king, but they still looked forward to his rule. So how do we develop? And the Psalms are given to help us develop faith in God's law, his word, and hope in God's king and his rule, that he's going to make things right. And it's equipped to help us through two great circumstances of life. The times when things are going really, really good, and we need to learn how to praise God and to say to God how grateful we are for the good things we have. And when things are not going good, when they are bad, when it seems that evil is ruling, we don't have to pretend, because the Psalms are filled with lament. Questions of how long, O Lord? Or Lord, when are you going to take care of them? And sometimes the Psalms even tell us how God is going to take care of people who violate his law and who basically have nothing to do with him. And it's not pretty. And so we're going to see some of that later on. But since I'm in charge, I get to pick the fun Psalms that I want to do. So actually, this is not a fun Psalm, but this Psalm, Psalm 32, is really an important psalm, and it's paired with another. So I'm going to do three things today. I'm going to show you the relationship it has to one of the other great psalms. I'm going to show you the content of the book, and then I hope to help you see some lessons of forgiveness from Psalm 32. So let's look at the ties between this psalm and another, and that other psalm I preached last year, Psalm 51. Psalm 51 and Psalm 32 are, according to most scholars, related, and we can see that relationship. These are two of what are called the penitential psalms, where David, or the writer, if it's not David, is confessing sin. That's something we have to do. We have to acknowledge when things are not right. Now, when it comes to Psalm 51, the setting, and this is a review from last year, the setting of Psalm 51 is immediately after David has been confronted by the prophet Nathan about his sin with Bathsheba. He committed adultery, and in order to do it and to cover it up, he plotted murder, and he lied about it and thought he had gotten away with it, but he hadn't. Nathan comes and tells him a story, confronts him and says, "You're the man," and it's a bad thing. And he acknowledges his sin immediately, and he's told he's forgiven, but consequences flow. A baby that was born dies. And David's family experiences the natural consequences of some of the things that he did. When you read Psalm 51, you get the sense this is just after all of this has happened. I mean, it is just raw with emotion. And he's just going on and on. "I can't believe what I have done. Oh God, I've sinned against you. And I need you." And as he goes through this rawness This psalm, Psalm 51, is one of the most emotionally powerful psalms of confession you could come across. And then as you get to the end, he says, God, since you're forgiving me and you've told me I'm forgiven, restore to me the joy of my salvation. Give me back that relationship. And when you do, as he gets to the end, he says this, then I will teach transgressors, that's other people who rebel against you, I'll tell them the right way. I'll tell them what you can do. And that's what Psalm 51 is. Then we come to Psalm 32, and Psalm 32 is David teaching transgressors. In fact, if we look at Psalm 32, we're going to see this is a more reflective treatment. And he's basically stepping back, and he's again rehearsing this time of great, great pain, but he's doing it from a distance. He's doing it as a man who has been forgiven. In fact, we're in Psalm 51, he starts out, have mercy. Psalm 32, he starts out, how blessed. So it's a more reasoned, seasoned reflection of the subject of forgiveness. It's a little further from the crisis. You know what that's like when you've gone through a crisis and you've come through it immediately. I mean, sometimes when I go through a crisis and come through it right afterwards, don't pay too much attention to what I say because I'll babble. You know, I'm just like, I'm so worked up about what's going on. It's like, I can't believe this. But then when you have time to step back, you still have the same gratefulness for deliverances. You still have the same encouragements, but you have a chance to kind of express more clearly how it progresses through, and that's what he does. Now, David said in Psalm 51, I will instruct transgressors how to experience God's forgiveness. That's what we find in Psalm 32. In fact, look at Psalm 32. I hope you have a copy of the scriptures in front of you, because right at the top it says, a maskil of David. A maskil, not a mosquito, a maskil. Okay? A maskil, this is one of those words that if your notes in the Bible are like mine, it says probably some sort of liturgical term. But interestingly enough, this word at its root is related to the very same Hebrew word for teaching, instructing. In fact, some translations, every time it's a maskil, they put an instruction of David. So if he is teaching transgressors, here it is. Starts right off in the introduction. All right, here's a teaching. And what's it going to be about? It's about the beauty that transgressors can experience in forgiveness. And we're going to see lots of touch points, places where Psalm 32 and Psalm 51 relate. Some of his descriptions are very, very similar. And you say, well, why is it before Psalm 51? Well, for a couple of reasons. Again, the organization of the Psalms follows along in certain things, and many of the themes that he touches on, this blessedness, for example. And he starts out with blessedness. That's so significant that he does that. And it has to do with, I think, where the author, not the author, the editor, the one who assembled and put this all together for worship was, he said, we're still in this section where we're blessing God and pointing people forward. Later on in the section around Psalm 51, we're dealing with some heavier things. But this relationship comes out. And so that's the relationship that we're going to proceed through. As you think of Psalm 32, if you still remember Psalm 51, that have mercy on me, oh God, wash me and I will be white, and all those kinds of things, just kind of keep that in the back of your mind as we think about Psalm 32. This psalm is also a favorite of a lot of people. I told you 51 was the favorite of the English reformers. They memorized Psalm 51, and many of them, as they were being taken to the stake to be burned, recited and led their family and friends who were walking with them in reciting Psalm 51, have mercy on me, O God. Interestingly enough, I found out this week that Augustine, the great church father from the 4th century, Augustine had this psalm inscribed on the wall. Now, you know, they had plaster walls, so he had it actually carved into the wall of the room where he was on his deathbed, so that he could just continue to remember it. And he was asked, why did you choose that one? And he said, and I won't give it to you in Latin, he said, the beginning of knowledge is to know yourself to be a sinner. The real beginning of knowledge is to know yourself to be a sinner. Because once you understand that and understand what God has done and how God has poured out grace, It changes everything. Well, let's look at the content of Psalm 32. Let's see if we can work through this fairly quickly. We've read it all together, but I hope you've got a copy in front of you because I'm going to point out a number of things. Notice it begins with a blessing. In fact, it begins with blessed. You know, we have only had one psalm up to this point in the book of Psalms that begins with blessed. I got to preach that one too. It was Psalm 1. Psalm 1, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. Now, I just gave it to you in King James because that's how I memorized it. So the words are a little bit different, but that's, you know, I'm old enough that I remember the original Bible. And I don't use it anymore, but I remember it. And, you know, I mean, that's a great one. Blessed, happy. How great is your life if you are the man who never walks with the ungodly, who doesn't take his stand with sinners, and doesn't sit down with those who are mocking God. Boy, how blessed that is. But you know, as aspirational as that is, and as much as I'd like to say, that's me all the time, it's not. I'm not always walking in the path I should go or taking my stand with the right people. Sometimes I kind of shy away from it. Sometimes I can fall into mocking. Which is what makes the second psalm that begins with blessed so important, because this is how blessed. How blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the one against whom the Lord does not count iniquity. You see, the first blessed, that's what we want. And we know when we're walking with God, how blessed it is. When I am walking with God, there is no life better. And the scriptures tell us over and over again, there is no life better than walking in obedience to God and following his instruction. We find blessing in that. But what happens when we're not there? Does that mean there's no hope for us? Oh no, when we confess our sins, it says, how blessed is the one whose transgression is covered, against whom that the Lord does not count iniquity. Actually, his sin is covered. He forgives his transgression. Lord, this is so great. When I'm walking with you, I can look forward to happiness. And if I've sinned and I come back to you, I can find that happiness again. I have heard some people kind of hold out the idea that, you know, if you sin too often, you're going to kind of be moved to the B league of Christianity. You know, you're not really up to the majors. You got to be in the minor leagues. God will still bless you. He'll still put up with you, but you've really kind of blown it. God really isn't interested in using you anymore. The theological term for that is baloney. You have to understand that what is held in front of us is the word of the psalmist talking about the 70 times 7 forgiving God who wants us to experience the same happiness David experienced in forgiveness. But you know, even as Christians who know that we have this promise of this blessing, we don't often grab hold of it. In fact, many of us are laboring still in some way with less than the blessing of forgiveness. And that's the concern of David. He wants to teach transgressors, you don't have to live that way. You can live a blessed life. And he speaks as one who has experienced this blessing. It's like someone who's just had this amazing experience. You have got to come see this. You have got to come and experience this. David is saying, you, sinner, transgressor, you need to come and experience this. It's amazing. Now, sometimes we hear people talk about those amazing experiences and we wonder, really? I mean, and some people do invite us to say, oh, this is the greatest thing ever, and you try it, and you go, meh. But this is really true. We know it because it's in the Bible. We know it from David's life. We know it from the testimony of so many thousands. Notice he gives this full-orbed picture. He says, And he uses three words. We'll talk about the three words more later, but he says, he talks about transgressions, he talks about sins, he talks about iniquities. All of these are different aspects of sin. We'll talk about that in a moment. But just what he's trying to present is this fully orbed idea that basically, however you view your sin, whatever category your sin falls into, there isn't a sin that God doesn't deal with, because each one of them is met with something. Transgression is forgiven. Sin is covered. Iniquities, not counted against you. All of that is true for us. But notice it says, in whose spirit there is no deceit. Now there he gives you a key to why many of us do not experience the joy of forgiveness. And that is, in our souls, we are not yet to the point of acknowledging just how sinful we really are. Because we think of our sins as, oh, I messed up. Kind of, you know, I sinned. Now, I didn't kill anybody, so that really would have been really, really bad, but I just lied. I didn't go out and commit adultery, I just lusted. I didn't steal anything, I just didn't tell them that they forgot to collect the money. And we have this conversation with ourselves, where we are constantly making little of our sin. I had a conversation with someone recently where they were describing a struggle with sin, and obviously one of the things I'm trying to do is point them to the idea that one of the struggles that we have, anytime there's any desire in our heart for anything more than we desire God, that has become an idol, and we have to deal with it and we have to kill it. And the thing is, it can be a good thing. It could be I want my family to look good. But these things can become idols if they come between us and full devotion to Christ. And I want to hold Christ out there as the treasure that is like the treasure in the field that is worth giving everything up for. You see, that's how salvation is described. And too often, because we don't want to acknowledge just how much we need that salvation, and we don't want to acknowledge it over and over again, and I'm speaking to Christians as well as to non-Christians, we want to kind of pretend God got a good deal when he got us. I've cleaned up pretty well. I've served him. I'm helping him. I'm doing all sorts of things for him. And you know, he may be saying, my child, you know, you are amazing, and I'll give you a star for that effort, but you need more. And it begins with getting the deceit out of our souls and being honest. And so in instructing us, David moves from the blessing to his testimony. He says, there was a time when I was not being honest with the people around me or with God. He says, when I kept silent. Did you know silence can be deceit? Silence can be deceit. When there's something we need to say to God, and we say, no, I'm not going to say that to God because I don't think it's that important, or he'll overlook it or whatever, we are basically deceiving. We're seeking to deceive God. We're seeking to deceive others. We're basically deceiving ourselves. Oh, and we're good at that. So instead of confessing his sin to the Lord, which he talks about later, he said, I just kept silent. Nope. I know it's wrong. I shouldn't have done it, but I did it. That's it. God's just going to have to deal with that. It's not that bad. I'll get it worked out. Did any of you try and do that? You ever try and work things out before you come to God in confession? You ever try and say, okay, well, I really blew it here, so I'll go sit in the penalty box for 5 minutes because I know God doesn't want to talk to me right now. And then I'll come out, and then he will talk to me because I'll show I'm really, really sad. Or I'll do two or three things that are good to kind of offset the real bad thing I did. And then I'll come and talk to God. David thought he could go about being king, dispensing justice, following the law. But something wasn't right. You know, when you're not honest with yourself and you won't admit what you need to admit to God, notice what he says, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. He says, this is painful. Some of you know that pain. Maybe some of you are in that pain. What kind of pain is it? What kind of physical pain? Look at the next verse. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as in the heat of summer. He says, I'm feeling no strength. I'm not resting. I'm thinking about it at night. I'm thinking about day. I'm thinking about it when I don't want to think about it. It's a thought I don't want, but it keeps coming back. I keep pushing it away. No, I'm not going to deal with that. And it comes back at the most inopportune times, when I want to sleep, or when I want to eat, or when I want to do something to enjoy myself. He says, your hand was heavy upon me. So often the scripture talks about it this way, but I've heard people talk about just feeling weighed down. Sometimes it's depression. And I'm not trying to say, please, please, please. Don't let her say, Pastor Craig said if you're depressed, you're hiding sin. No, I am not saying that. Depression can come from many, many different corners and quarters, but sin can be a cause for us to feel heaviness of spirit, because we know something's not right and we know we need to deal with it, but knowing that we have to deal with it means I have to come clean. I have to come clean maybe with other people, but I have to come clean with God, and I'm afraid of what God is going to do. I mean, look at the things God does to people who rebel against him. He smites them. What a great biblical word. I do not want to be smitten. I do not want to be swept away in a flood. I do not want fire to fall from heaven. This is a God who, when he gets mad, he gets mad. And I don't want to admit, because I'm afraid of what I may have to go through. Maybe I'll be embarrassed. That's the worst. Maybe fire wouldn't be so bad. David said, I just felt like your hand was just pressing down on me. And boy, there is nothing like having the eternal God of the universe going like this on your life. You feeling that? You ever felt it? You know how horrible it is. It just doesn't seem even the things that should give you joy don't give you joy. Then he comes to verse 5. And this is where his testimony goes. He says, I was doing this. I was keeping silent. I wasn't saying anything, but I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not cover my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. This is the longest sentence in the psalm. Many people believe it's the most important sentence in the psalm. And interestingly enough, you have three times in this psalm where you have that little word that we usually don't comment on, Selah, S-E-L-A-H, in the margin there. Most people believe that that is like a term that if you're in the music or in the poetry, where the idea is pause here and think about this. So, in verses 1 to 4, he's basically, there's a blessedness if you're going to be honest, but if you're not going to be honest, this is what it feels like. Stop and think about that. Is that you? Is that where you are? Are you feeling the oppression, the pressure? That you haven't been honest, not just with God, but with yourself? About how much you need God's forgiveness, how much you need his grace right now? And then he says, I acknowledged my sin to you. And I didn't cover my iniquity. I said, and here he is talking to himself, I'm going to confess my transgressions to the Lord. And you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Stop and think about that. One verse, stop and think about that. And we need to. How did it resolve? After all of this heaviness, he finally came to the point of saying, this isn't worth it. I read the Bible and I see great sin. I see Peter who denied the Lord restored. I see believers who have failed brought back into fellowship.
I see people like David who killed and cheated and lied, forgiven, and able to sing praises to his God openly without shame. He said, so I finally acknowledged my sin to you. I didn't cover my iniquity. I said, I'll confess my transgressions. Again, all three words. And notice it's a full-on confession. And he says, I will confess my sins to the Lord. And it says, and it follows right on this. It's not even a new sentence. He said, and you forgave. You didn't say you would forgive. You didn't say, okay, well, let's talk about it. You forgave, past tense, the iniquity of my sin. Do you know what that says? It's immediate. There is no penalty box. There is no thought that, okay, you're sorry, prove it. Well, before you really experience grace, I want you to suffer just a little bit more. See, that's how people operate. That is not how God operates. When Nathan confronted him and he said, I've sinned, Nathan said to him immediately, under the direction of God, your sin is pardoned. You will not die. Because he had committed numerous sins for which the penalty was, in fact, death. You know, when God forgives us of our sins, he is forgiving us the penalty we deserve. But notice it says, you forgave the iniquity of my sin. That means the way that my sin played out in me. God, you not only forgive the offense, you often, you regularly, you forgive us for what it led to. I'll explain more about that later. Doesn't this remind you of another story that we're familiar with in the New Testament? About a father who had two sons, and one who had no appreciation for his father and his goodness and said, give me my inheritance, and he left and spent everything he had and found himself eating with pigs, which for a good Jewish boy is a pretty bad place to be. And he began to talk to himself and say, how many of my father's hired servants are doing so much better than me? I will arise and I will go to my father and I will confess my sin. But do you remember the story? The father who is watching for that son sees him a great way off, runs to him. And the son begins his confession. We know the speech because we got Jesus telling us how he'd formed it in his mind. But he only gets part of it out. Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He doesn't even get to finish before his father says, bring the fattened calf. Put a robe on my son. Bring a ring. Let's celebrate. He forgives him immediately. Do you understand? That's how God does things. God doesn't have a time frame in which you have to demonstrate to me that you deserve it this time. The reason he doesn't do that is we don't deserve it at all. We just sang it. Grace. Grace. That is greater than all our sin. And you may be sitting here and saying, you don't understand. I'm on about my 147th round of confession and forgiveness if you're talking about doing it again. Oh, you got some folks here that you got a long way to catch up with. Frankly, every day we start out, we need to say something like, God, I have yet to live a day completely and wholeheartedly abandoned to you. But that's my goal. Help me do that today. Help me do that today. And the amazing thing is that the forgiveness was immediate. Then David moves to an admonition in verses 6 and 7. And he says to us, and this is where the instruction comes. Therefore, all right, I've told you the great thing, the blessedness. I've told you what it was like when I wouldn't be honest. And I've told you what it's like when I finally said, God, I need to confess this to you. And he forgave me immediately. So here's the lesson. Let everyone who is godly, you say, well, wait a minute, I don't feel godly. Godly is not a feeling. Godly is a state of being, and there's only two categories of people. There's the godly and the ungodly. The ungodly say there is no God. The godly say there is a God, and I need to try and follow him. So the real problem is when godly people live like ungodly people. So now he's saying, godly people, you who say there's a God that we deal with, here's what you do. Everyone who is godly, offer prayer to you, God, at a time when you may be found. Surely, he says, call out to God and find if he's there, and you're going to find that he is. Then he says, surely the rush of great waters shall not reach him. The rush of great waters, what are you talking about? Well, you know how I mentioned before how we worry about God really coming after sin like he did in the flood? The flood was people's almost favorite analogy in the Psalms for times of real judgment. You want to talk judgment? Talk flood. He says, well, you know when those rushing waters like a flood come in? They won't reach you. God's ultimate judgment will not fall on the godly. Why? Because you are my hiding place. You are a hiding place for me. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with shouts of deliverance. Now, if God surrounds you with shouts of deliverance, people saying, delivered, I'm delivered, who's making the shouts of deliverance? Well, God may be saying, you're delivered. It may be angels, but you know what I think is going on here? When we finally own up to our sin and confess it and we're with God's people, the great relief is discover, whew, we're all that way. Now, I know we often do our best to pretend that we are not sinners, that there are a few sinners that come in amongst us every once in a while, but we're not sinners. But I got news for you. I'm looking out on a sea of sinners here. I'm looking out on a sea of liars and lusters and stealers, if nothing else, of glory from God every time you claim credit for it. I'm looking out on some horrible people who have been turned into saints by the grace of God. And that is what should make the church a safe place. And what makes it an unsafe place is when we all pretend that grace is great for everyone else, but I've been so changed by it, I don't really need it much anymore. Brothers and sisters, the church is meant to be a place where when the sinner comes and says, I've blown it, all of us shout, hallelujah, you're delivered just like me. We're told that not only will we find this deliverance, we're told to stop and think about that for a while. Did you catch that? There's a third one. Stop and think. Stop and think. Here's the lesson. You need to seek God when you need him. Right then. And you'll find deliverance. And then we have God speaking. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Now, we in the King James, we kind of mess that up a little. I will guide you with the apple of mine eye was the phrase there. And the idea, we kind of felt like, oh, that means we're special. No, you know what it's saying? God is promising. You confess, you come to me, and you're saying, okay, I don't want to do that again, God. I want to be right with you. Keep me right with you. God says, I will. This is my promise. I will instruct you. And I will teach you in the way you should go. Okay, God, how, where? Here you go. I wrote it all down. Read it. Study it. Memorize it. Think about it. That's it? Oh, yeah. Now, there are ways God's going to make it real to you. There are ways God's going to use people to show you aspects of it you haven't understood. There are times when God may do some incredible things to drive home its lessons, but all the lessons are anchored right here. He said, I'll instruct you, I'll teach you, I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Now, that is not the apple of mine eye, I'm so special. No, that is, I'm going to give you counsel from the Word and my Spirit working in you and working through people and telling you, and I'm going to keep my eye on you. Now, that is not, I'm going to keep my eye on you to smite you. There's that biblical word again. I'm going to keep my eye on you because I don't want you to go astray again either. And I'm going to bring things to bear in your life. I'm going to have circumstances come up, and I'm going to have people come up, and there are going to be people around there. So you don't have to go astray. I will provide that counsel for you. And then he says, now listen, you can resist it. Verse 9, don't be like a horse or a mule without understanding, who must be curbed with bit and bridle, or it won't stay near you. He says, I got two ways I can deal with you. I can give you the Bible, and you can study it, and you can learn it, and you can draw on counsel from other people, and you can be blessed in all those ways, or I can treat you like a mule. Your choice. What do you want? There are some of you right now that have very sore upper mouths because you have chosen the other way. And God is constantly having to pull and pull and tug and pull back. And he'll do that because he loves you too much to leave you like you are. But he says, there's another way. Listen to my instruction. Study it. Learn it. And he says, if you'll do that, you know what you're going to experience? Not the sorrows of the wicked. You're going to experience steadfast love. And I got to do it because it's my favorite word in Hebrew. This is the word that speaks of covenant love. It's sometimes translated loving kindness. It's chesed. I love making that sound. Chesed. It's God never letting go. When you follow and listen, you experience what's true. I never, never let you go. So, in conclusion, he gives a benediction, verse 11. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, O righteous. Who's righteous? You are, if you believe in Jesus. And shout for joy, all you upright in heart. Whose heart is upright? You are, if you've been forgiven by Jesus. He goes back to the lesson of blessedness. He says, this is for you. Don't you want this? Well, very quickly, let me give you four lessons in forgiveness that we get from Psalm 32. First, if you're not understanding how serious sin is, you have a threefold description of the deadliness of sin. Those three words, powerful. But you also have the threefold deliverance that God brings in forgiveness. Threefold nature of sin. Look at those synonyms. It is transgression. Transgression. You know, that could have just as easily been translated rebellion. Rebellion. Blessed is the one whose rebellion against your rule, God, has been forgiven. Sin is rebellion against our true King. It is also sin. That second word, sin. And I told you about this last year, and you've heard it almost every time we talk about this. And Romans 3:23 captures it. Sin, hamartia in the New Testament, is related to the Hebrew Old Testament word, which means missing a mark, falling short. It was an archery term. I am not an archer. Okay? And so I get this. The target is way out there. They give me a bow. They give me an arrow. They say, hit the target. The target is the law of God. It's God's standard. I pull back as much as I can and I let it go, but I let it go kind of wrong and it just kind of flips over and falls about 4 feet in front of me. You may be better. But the idea here is it's a target no one can reach, as if we're here and the target's in Columbus and you have just a regular bow. Some of you may get a lot closer, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to mean much of anything because everybody falls short. Sin is falling short of God's law, and that's what he judges on. And then the third word is iniquity. This is a word that talks about what sin does to us, because it's the idea of twisting and corrupting. Transgression is rebellion against God, and the standard of that rebellion is the law, that's sin. But iniquity is when we rebel and when we sin, it changes us, it corrupts us, it does something bad to us. And it turns us into a twisted person, so we sin and we sin and we hurt and we don't care. When we hurt other people, we do things that are terrible. But then there's restoration's triple blessing. Notice he says, what about forgiveness? Well, what is forgiveness? Forgiveness is to lift something off of somebody when it's weighing them down and removing it. And then it says not only forgiven, but covered. This is a word that applied to the sacrifices in the Old Testament. You know, when they would offer the blood of sacrifice in the Holy of Holies during the Day of Atonement to take care of your sin, the high priest would take a bowl of the blood of an animal. And he'd look, and here would be the cherubim with their wings extended. And right in the middle is where the presence of God was seen to be and believed to be. And that's where God dwelt. So how do we approach God? And right underneath in that ark were the Ten Commandments. And that's the standard that the people had broken. And so the high priest would come in with blood of sacrifice, speaking of the death of those who should have died, but instead an animal died. And that blood is applied to what was called the mercy seat, the covering over that ark. So that covering came between God and his holiness and his wrath and the law that condemned us. And it turned it away. This very word comes into the New Testament as a big theological word, propitiation. The turning away of God's wrath from your sin and my sin. Your sin is covered so that wrath does not come at you anymore. And then the third one is really a negative, not counting. Not counting. He doesn't count against us our iniquity. This word to count positively appears in Genesis 15:6. Abraham believed God and it was counted, another way of saying it is imputed, credited to him as righteousness. Do you know what Paul does in Romans chapter 4? Paul takes the story of Abraham, Genesis 15, and the words of David, Psalm 32, 1 and 2, and he says, this is what your salvation in Jesus is. He counts Christ's righteousness toward you. And he does not count your iniquities against you. That's your salvation. That's what Jesus did. And of all the things David wrote, isn't it interesting? It's right here that Paul says, that's salvation. And so, you've rebelled. God takes that and takes it away from you. You've been one who has missed the mark, your failure is covered. You've been one that has seen how sin has twisted you and done things in you and through you. What does it say? It says God doesn't count it. He does not credit it to you. You know why? He credits Christ's righteousness to you, and he credits that against Jesus on the cross. Second lesson I just want you to see is that one little phrase there about a window of opportunity. Notice it says that you need to call on the Lord, offer prayer to him at a time when he may be found. Do you know that in God's sovereignty, there are many moments when God leaves that door open? He leaves it open for people who've never repented of their sin. In fact, Paul says in Corinthians, now is the accepted time. Now is a day of salvation. Isaiah 55, Isaiah says exactly the same thing that David says when he says it. Let me get it here, if I can get it. There we go. Isaiah 55, verses 6 and 7. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and let the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, that he may have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Right now, this is a window of opportunity for you. If you've never trusted Jesus Christ, you can seek his forgiveness right now. But the Bible tells us that opportunity, that window, doesn't last forever. Believer, you've been rebelling against God. You've been hiding your sin. You haven't been dealing with your sin. Right now, this is a moment of opportunity. But you know, in his sovereignty, there are times when God seems to remove that sense of conviction and let you continue to go on in sin, and things can get worse and worse because that's part of his way of trying to draw you back to himself. But do you want it to get worse? You have an opportunity right now. You say, but I'm so embarrassed. You shouldn't be, because every single one of us would be dead right now if it weren't for the grace of God. Could be a question of where you hide. David tried to hide his sin, and how you hide. He tried to hide his sin. He tried to hide from God. And that's one choice that you have. Or you can hide in God, verse 7. Like the old hymn writer said, rock of ages cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. When troubles come, when those waves of trouble and judgment are falling, God, I want to be found hidden in you. So I would just ask you, where is your sin? Where is your sin? Is it still yours? Are you still holding on to it? If you've never trusted Christ, you're still holding on to your sin, thinking you can deal with it yourself. And if you're a Christian, you may still be holding on to some sin that just feels so good, or it's just too hard to let go. Well, your sin will either be yours, or it will be lifted off you and placed somewhere else. In fact, it will be placed on Jesus. One of my favorite hymns speaks of this hope. And I think we're going to close this way. I'm not going to pray. I'm just going to have us sing these words in just a moment. If you're here today and you need Christ, if you're here today and you belong to Christ, but you just need prayer, or maybe you just want to pray with someone and thank God for his forgiveness, our elders are going to be right up here up front at the end of the service. We're here for you. If there's anything we can do for you, but take whatever you need from this window of opportunity. The man who wrote these words had experienced a great tragedy in his life. His children had died on a sea voyage that took place after they'd lost everything in the Chicago fire. And his wife sent him a telegram saying, "Saved alone." She was the only one that survived. He sat down, and I actually have a copy of the words that he wrote from the hotel where he was staying when he got the news. And the hymn, "It Is Well," is probably familiar to you. I'd like us to just sing this verse as our final reminder that we don't have to carry our sin anymore. Would you stand with me? Don't have any instruments? You'll just have to follow me as best I can. There's a chorus. "It is well with my soul, it is well with my soul." I'll lead you in it. I think a lot of you know it. Just this verse. Sing it with me. "My sin, oh, the bliss of this glorious thought. My sin, not in part, but the say this: "It is well with my soul, it is well, it is well with my soul."